All right. So today we will look again into this great thing. I prepared the whole file there. You can find all things in one particular file, the terms for word and language in Sanskrit. It's 40 pages file, covers all the things we have to look into. So today we will be dealing with these treatises, starting from Nirukta, which is the first treatise, 600 BC. It's treatise on etymology, Ashtadhyayi Panini, the grammar, Vyakaranam, which is approximately 500 BC, nobody knows exactly when and how. Mahabhashya, commentary of Patanjali on Ashtadhyayi, and Vakyapadiya, which comes later, of Bhartrihari. But what, before coming to these texts, I would like to look again into that scheme which we made in our tantric research, and that was the scheme of two realities coexisting in one, as you remember. And this is it. This is the scheme. So, yeah. So, you remember we discussed that question about what is it and how we know what we know about this thing, and we said that it's a pen and that it's stick-like, white color, and so on and so forth, and we knew about it through the word. By the word we know what it is, because the word tells us an application, tells us something which we cannot see this thing does or is meant to do. Even not does, because it doesn't write. And we still know that it will write if we apply it to write. So this knowledge is not visible in this thing. It does not say to us that it writes. Actually, in English, we do not know even about that from language. A pen does not say a thing about writing. It confuses only. You have to remember that a pen is to write. In Sanskrit it is easier. It's lekhani. Lekhani means writing thing. So it tells you what it does. And that's how Sanskrit is more living language than any other language. Because it tells you exactly where what it does. You don't need to learn it somewhere separately. That's what we call transparent. Etymologically it is a transparent language. Now we do not know what table, why table is table, why chair is to sit. In Sanskrit it will be asanam, sitting thing, utpitika, supporting thing, lekhani, writing thing, and so on and so forth. In English we have to remember it. So we learn in English by symbolic, so to say, so we have double symbolism in our mind. So. But here again we are coming to this particular scheme, and I wanted to tell you that these two realities coexist. One is the reality of the word and linguistic reality, another is the reality of the form, rupam, you remember rupam? Rupa, form, and nama, name. So, this form exists in this particular format, stick-like, white, and so on and so forth. It has ink inside, but the name of it is lekhani, writing thing. So we have two coexisting realities with us, which we are always matching. We are matching our linguistic space with the reality of things. And how it is matched and why it is matched, it's the whole discussion in linguistics and philosophy of language. If they are matching well, then there is no question, but they are always mismatching. So one is called the artha, as you see those who know Sanskrit, the meaning. Interesting, artha means a thing, actually, but it is also a meaning, and other is a word, sound. Meaning and sound, they are not connected, or they are disconnected in the reality. So we have to learn about meaning, how it is applied to the whole context, separately. We have to learn about the span, seeing it writing, yes? Though the concept, the name is there, the meaning is somewhere in the highest plane, as we saw, they are matching, pan and a fan. Yes? There are two realities, you can see them, two different realities, they are matching on the semantic level of paravak. Both have the same meaning, to write. Then on the level of form sounds and form images, they shift, they split, because in this reality it has to be stick-like, to fit into the hand of man, and not to fit into something else. So it becomes a stick-like because it's more convenient to write. And here it has its own word application. So to say pan is in the structure of syntax of the language, has certain relations with the hand, with the paper, with writing, with publishing, and so on and so forth. Many relations which are reflecting the reality of in the form. And on the objective, so to say, vaikari level, they are completely two different realities. One is a written word, and the other is reality. I do not know, I'm not confusing you. It's quite clear, these two realities, how they build up one action of consciousness. Why am I speaking about this again so long? Because without this, there is no linguistics. All linguistics is turning around only around this particular thing. This was called by Bhartrihari, and I will try to do already, Vajaka. Vajaka, the indicator, that which tells you what it is, how it is with others. Yes, Vajaka, from Vajayati, to make it speak what it is, so to say, to indicate. And this is Vajya. Vachya, that which is spoken, or should be indicated. So this is the signified, we call it signified in linguistics, and this is a signifier. So the relation between signified and signifier is all that what we have to look into when we are studying linguistics. How the meaning, that is which is signified, relates to that which is signifying this meaning. Well, there are speculations, there are philosophies built on this. The whole phenomenology is nothing but the relation of these two. The whole philosophical world is nothing but these two and how they relate, and all speculations about it. How the reality relates to our linguistic reality, and how they match or mismatch, and why. Does it make sense? You can see such a simplicity in this linguistics. Now I am moving into a very important part, and we will start with our first niruktam, the first treatise on the etymology. So there is a discussion in Yaskas Nirukta The arguments of a critic are given as follows. I will be very brief, not to take your mind somewhere else. Every being should be called by the same name when performing the same action. So Vipashva, horse, means running, from Ashu to be swift. It's a swift being. Then everyone who is running should be called Ashva. We are all horses in some way. Some horses are running, some horses are working hard, you know. All right. So the horse is not only running, it's also working hard on the fields, at least in Europe. Here they are not working on the fields, they are mainly kind of, you know, they were lost in India for a while, and Maharajas had horses only coming from kind of Middle East and from the Kazakhstan, and these horses were treated nearly like, you know, in the medieval period, like queens and kings. They were given plow to eat, they were eating rice and all this. They didn't know how to really breed these horses. It wasn't their culture, so those horses didn't live long on plow. They needed the grass. This culture was lost in India. We can see only these statues in Tamil Nadu, but there are no horses. So long ago they were here, but very long ago. So I'm not about that, sir. It's all about this particular relation. Look what a critic says. He says, if there is one match of the particular word, and I have to refer to the scheme, if the word is to match with reality, why this word is not matching every reality in the same way? Why this word has to be only for particular and not always applied to everything else? And it's a question. Actually, in Chinese language, there will be a solution to this. It's more universal. Those signs can be applied more universally than in this particular language. So Ashva, if it is a horse, it gets certain character. Character which you cannot deny, yes? You can draw out of it again swiftness and use it symbolically, but you cannot put it down saying that Ashva is swift, that's why everybody who is swift is Ashva. So every object should be called by as many names as actions are performed by it, for the designation of an object is anyhow not clear. It's interesting, yeah? It's 600 BC. It's not clear when it is determined only by its action, for it can perform any action and exists in itself before and after the action. Now there's something mysterious about the object, and we can clearly see that there is a mismatch between physical reality and the linguistic reality. In the linguistic reality, swiftness can be applied in our mind to any object, but in reality it gets kind of correlation or correction. And that correction of life into the linguistic space makes all this mess. They are not one-to-one fitting. So the explanation to this Yaska gives, his answer, not everyone gets the same name by performing the same action. It's quite interesting. Why is that so? Not everyone gets the same name by performing the same action. Not everyone who cuts wood is called Takshan, a carpenter, but only one who does it often and regularly. So there is a certain kind of settlement or agreement between these two realities. Though one is involved in many different activities, one gets his name from a particular action only, not from all those activities. There are even many things which get their names from their subsequent actions. Did you notice this interesting thing that when we give nicknames, we see somebody doing something and it was so funny that we give that name, and that name is stuck to you for many years and you can do nothing about it. Somehow that preference to give a name of that particular subsequent action is dominating all other names, because you are cognizable as unique in that particular sense. So we can indicate you as a unique object of some kind. It's not that we want to be true to our linguistic space, but we want to cognize you as unique. That can be the answer, why these names of subsequent actions are applied and are stuck to us, nicknames. What we see here is that a critic, by his arguments, is trying to identify the image created by a word as it functions in linguistic reality with the image of an object in its functions of in objective reality. He wants to establish a true correspondence between these two levels of reality, nearly like Confucius wanted to do it for China, one of which lies beyond time and space, that is linguistic reality, which is not really in this time and space of proper reality, in the subjective realms, and the other in the objective time and space. The critic seems to understand the problem very well when he says that an object cannot be defined by a word, for it exists, the object exists, before and after the action that the word indicates. And this is exactly where the problem lies. If the object continues to exist and performance of particular action is done, then why it should be called by that name all the time? So it will be only called by that name in the moment when it performs that, but we have to identify it. So we need to have a name, primary name, to that action which it will. Now, why am I saying all this? Because we will come to this particular notion of syntax, where there are two names used, and Jaska is using two particular words. One is nama, name, and the other is akhyata, the predicate. Name and predicate, two different names. He doesn't use kriya, he doesn't use verb. He uses a secondary name. So there must be two names. There must be a major name, and that was the whole discussion, why not everybody is called Ashva when he runs. Yes, everybody is Ashva when he runs in here, but not here. Here, Ashva, when it runs, it's only that which has that particular notion of Ashva as the horse. Only horse will be here. And here, horse can be any other also object. So, one unique primary name and secondary name. Major name and secondary name. And we were looking into this, you remember I was joking that until I clarify the predicate, it's not clear what I'm saying. If I say a tree is, or I am, what? We want to know what? We want to know this secondary name, because it's not clear why to say I am and not to finish it. And until I finish it, it's not clear what I want to say. You remember I made long sentence with kind of trying to bring you to the attention of that particular thing, where, by the way, if you look at it from different angles, and I'm not telling you akhyata, and you're waiting for it with all your attention, and I can speak to you two pages of text of this kind, you will be exhausted. But you will hold the thread from the primary name to the secondary until I finalize it. And when I put at the end what it is and put full stop, then you will be then you will catch this spot, and this is spot.
I have a question. I've noticed many times when the Tamil people are speaking to you, they speak English but not very well. Sometimes you understand the words, but you
Yes, because Tamil language is different. Differently built, it's a agglutinative type of language. So what they do, they collect affixes into one word and make long words. It's like, in, you know, Hungarian children, they even play this game. They build long words with many, many affixes. And for them it's fun. But if you bring this structure to anybody who is from synthetic or analytic type of languages, they will be exhausted. It doesn't make sense to them. It's not self-evident. This has to be self-evident. Unity. One equals something. Yes. One. This equals what? There can be any sum here. And this any sum will be considered as one to this name. Yeah. This we have to see. That's how syntax works. There is no other syntax. Only one equals something. There has to be always this kind of equality between two parts, the major name and the secondary name. So, why I'm saying this? Because here, there is a misplacement. Yeah? There is no clarity about this, how, why, that object, this nama, has to be called by this, and why not every who is doing this is called by this. You see the non-clarity in this? Because there are two different names and have two different positions, and they have to be treated differently and not as the same. So, speaking generally, philosophically, it's not a proper question. But because it is not proper, we can see it clearly what it means. It's very useful for us to see these things. But we may say that the word persists in its own reality beyond the reality of time and space. Since we live, act, see, understand the word, the world, using our linguistic reality, the name once given to the object, whether it was relevant or seemed to be relevant for a particular speaker, could remain for some time. And that's what happens to nicknames. Though they are irrelevant altogether, they stay because they underline that unique perception of the person and brings it into life every time when the nickname is spoken, mentioned. So the reason why this or that name was given to the object was not in order to satisfy an objective reality, but rather a subjective one. There was a satisfaction in naming that object for the subjective perception, and not for the objective truth of things. Now, it makes full sense to me now, yes? Because there is an enjoyment within of naming things and seeing them differently than they are. Expecting them to be different and enjoying that difference. It's fun. There is a humor in it. There is a beauty in this naming it, not in a proper sense, not to be fully true. It was named by a speaker imposing his wish, opinion, knowledge, will on the object, after all, which maybe that object didn't want to have. And exercising that will and enjoying it. And if object would agree, he would enjoy also. Once the name has been used, it would persist in memory until a new name effaces or changes it. So in that citta which we studied, you know, the citta, all the storage of things is there in our next class on the philosophy of evolution. It is there where it persists and comes, pops in every time. So Yaska emphasizes the difference between the two realities, as well as pointing to the corrupted and conventional character of the word. You see, this is where we are becoming flat, one-dimensional being, this philosophical language. Corrupted character of the word. It's not corrupted. it satisfies subjective reality. That's what I want to say. But we see it as corrupted because it does not correspond to signified. Now, the whole philosophy, phenomenology is built on this. Where is that ultimate signified, as Heidegger will point it? And unfortunately, Rod has to be somewhere else. He would really contribute to this. Where is that ultimate signified, you know?
But that means also to be aware who has the power of to be the signifier, because he creates a reality for the other ones, or can impose it on them. So that is also...
Everybody has a power to make fun of this reality, because we are all born here for the same reason. The signified taken seriously, to which the signifier is to match, there is no match for signified. That's what Heidegger says. There is ultimate signified to which there is no match of the signifier, because it will be always off. In the moment it is used, it is already not in its own proper time. It's always off. As the reader will say, signifier is that which is never that, and signified is that which is never there. So with this never there, never that, we try to perceive the world. It makes sense if you think deeply about these things. Never that is signifier, yes, because it is never reaching the signified. And signified is never there because you are persisting in the signifier's reality, which is never that. So here you are. So in between these two, there is something expressed in consciousness and action and life, which is real. These two are not fully real, but together they make a reality. That's the Derrida's vision, his philosophical thinking. Yes. So, this is about Yaska. I will not read to you everything, but it's quite interesting, but I will go ahead and... So you can see the question from the beginning was how this signifier reality should fit to the signified reality and why they do not match. Now, Ashtadhyayi of Panini, I have to mention only a few words because it is irrelevant here for this course. It's a most profound treatise on grammar, but it is descriptive grammar. It's not philosophical, there is nothing here to discuss. In itself, it's an interesting exercise, and I studied it for several years in Pune University and translated two first books into Russian of Panini, 8 books. He made a unique contribution to the grammatical, or to even say to linguistics in general and philosophy of language. How he did it? He composed 4,000 sutras, 4,000 small sutras, very short, very brief, and by those 4,000 sutras, if you print them, it will be on 20-25 pages altogether. On 25 pages, he covered all grammatical relations, descriptions of grammar, morphology, syntax, accentuation, all exceptions within Sanskrit, Vedic language. You cannot imagine what it is. If you really properly spell it out, you would have 2 volumes, I can show you, such big 2 volumes. And it is 25 pages. So he invented, he describes language in 5 syllogisms. Syllogism. A syllogism, you say?
Syllogism.
Jism, yeah? So these 5 different relations, he says yes, he says better yes, either or, better no, no. There are 5 different possibilities of describing language. Not yes or no, but better yes, better no, either or. So because of these varieties of possible relations, he can deal with living language. He can incorporate more material. So he developed all his, and his grammar is built in such a way that he employs this particular function as anuvritti, here it is described, which is doing this, that when any rule is mentioned, it is implied throughout the text, unless it is specified. So he doesn't have to mention rules all the time, because once it is mentioned, it is implied. So he does not repeat himself. And in that sense, he became very brief. He is using the system of anubandhas, indicators, which are very relevant also not to repeat and not to say many words. For example, all his alphabet is marked with anubandhas. Ayun, rilk, nk, aiun, anubandha, rilk, k, ban, anubandha. So all these ayun, rilk, eon, ayau, chö, hayavarat, lang, yamangaranam, all these anubandhas, what they do, if he wants to say, for example, in the place of E and U, there will be guna. E, U, Ri, Li. In the place of E, U, Ri, Li will be guna and vriddhi. It's the first sutra. And how he says this? Iko, guna, vriddhi. Iko, guna, vriddhi. Iko implies that in the place of four vowels, there will be these changes. So he doesn't say I, U, Ri, Li. He doesn't specify. He found his meta-language, as we say, language which is applicable only to his grammar, by which he describes his grammar. It's a genius of some kind, and up to now nobody can understand, because he did it only orally. It was not written. It's all in the mind. And it is not linear. So the connections are not linear there. So you can jump from sutra to sutra. You can go into depth. It's as if three-dimensional in your mind. So these sutras are studied in certain schools. In one of the schools in London, where they are teaching especially Panini, for the sake of learning logic. School of Philosophy and Economics in London. They were here, these people, wonderful people, they're teaching Sanskrit, and especially Panini, to learn to think. I will not take more time. Mahabhashya of Patanjali, the same Patanjali who wrote Yoga Sutras, he is known as a great grammarian. And he has a wonderful and a huge treatise, many volumes. It was published in 8 volumes. Of Mahabhashya, the commentary on Panini. Now, he is the first one, the same Patanjali of Yoga Sutras, who introduces signified and signifier. Sporta. It was him who is introducing Sporta. Those Sportayana, the first grammarians, are mentioned that they were before Panini, but he is first who is dealing with this. But what is interesting here, you will see the shift. Mahabhashya, what he says, so in his Mahabhashya he says that in order to know the meaning of a word, one has to go not to the learned linguist, it's interesting, but to the marketplace and see there how the word is used, what people mean by it. You see the shift from the mythical towards the mental usage already, towards mental structure, in Gibserian terms. So the life which the word as a signifier has in the world is different from the conceptual or signified part of it. This was a new approach to human tongue in comparison to the Vedic theories of origins of speech. Patanjali points out to a different value of speech which had not been focused on before, a communicative aspect in the life of a signifier in relation to the signified. Yes, what he does, it's quite interesting, and you will see already mental approach. He takes three words, kupa, supa, and yupa, and he wants to examine their meanings, and he says that these three words differ only in k, s, and y phoneme. So they have different meanings, but if I remove k, s, y in itself does not have meaning. So therefore, phoneme doesn't have meaning. Phonema doesn't have any meaning, that's what he says. It is exactly what Saussure says in 20th century, where the linguistics starts from his observation that the phonema doesn't have any meaning. I do not know how to rightly say phoneme or phonema. Phoneme. Since I studied linguistics in Russian, it is so deeply engraved in me that I have to always doubt those words. Phoneme, phoneme. So what he does something illegitimate. He splits, he makes k, s, y as if it is a separate sound, as if it is a language of letters. And it is not a language of letters, but syllables. It's a syllabic language. Syllabic means that there must be after k some vowel. There is no k as such. You cannot say k without making k, has to be there to make k heard. So this was known to previous linguists. So they were never treating it in this particular way. It's a mental way of treatment. So he cuts it from ku, su, and yu. If he would examine ku, su, yu, he would see the difference. There are three different roots, ku, su, yu. And three of them build different world families. If you take ku, from here we have, you know, cave. From here we have cup. From here we have in Russian kopat, to excavate, to make a cave, 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 ko, ku, you hear this? Kupa, kup, this cup, this kup is that which has hole in it. This is the etymological root which gave many families of words and roots. Su, supa, soup, which is soup, is to extract, to press out, to. From here we have soma, from here we have savitri, and so on and so forth, all these words. Sunu, the sun, who is an essence and is extraction from you towards the future, which you generate, which you procreate, and so on and so forth. So from here we have soup. As a essence, as a what we eat. Yeah? Yupa, also the same way. Yu is the root which has two meanings, to unite and to hold two in one and to divide. Yes. It's this kind of post to which the sacrificial animal is tied, this duality of the post and somebody tied to you. And we have so many words from here, yoga, huge, yoke. Yoke is the same thing which you put on the horse, to yoke, and so on and so forth. So if he would examine these words from the root, from etymon's point of view, he would find the difference. But he split them, he mutilated them, and he says that there is no meaning in Varna. And this is a big blunder of Patanjali, as I consider. Though you will find in Western linguistics, everybody praises Patanjali, saying that he was already envisioning what Saussure did in 20th century. Look, in 200 BC, Patanjali already knew what we didn't know in 19th century in Europe. But it is exactly where the blunder is, a mistake. in my point of view. But what is interesting here is that Patanjali first, who speaks about single entity, he compares it with a chariot. He takes a chariot and he says, is a wheel chariot? No, wheel is not the chariot. Is the seat chariot? No. Is that chariot, all the parts? He says, the chariot appears when all the parts composing it are in a proper arrangement, then we see the chariot. So the chariot is not those parts, but an entity. So he speaks about single entity, and that is what it is about semantic for him. He doesn't speak about etymon. He recomposes the word in relation to the signified rather than signifier.
So as if we only speak that very objects, we don't see them.
Exactly. Yes, as if what is happening now, that he is seeing as if the world is projecting objects and we name it for our mind, as if the objective reality is that which is defining our naming process and not subjective reality. So we can clearly see a cut between Vedic, which was purely subjective and the words were coming from their own etymological reality, system of etymons, that you could apply every word to any reality and name it. Now we see that we have to learn about the word from the marketplace. We go to the market and we hear how it is used and we know what it is. So it's a complete loss of that origin of etymons. It's starting from Patanjali's time. But what is interesting here from this point of view of Spota theory, and it is also the beginning of this theory, that he says, he proposes first three different approaches to studies of speech utterance. Meaningful word, dvani, an uttered sound, and spota shabda, an impression of the sound in the mind. Now from here we start with this particular approach of spota. So the meaningful word is perceived through articulated sound, dvani. That sound, what we hear outside, we rearticulate in our mind, and that is spota shabda. This was the beginning of spota theory. Now we will come properly to spota theory, and you will see what it means in detail. I think we have time for that. I'm a little bit rushing, it's not good, because this material deserves really dwelling on. But I kind of think that we will come to it, to the spot of today. Now, Bhartrihari is a great thinker who introduces spota theory in his Vakyapadiya. And Bhartrihari is now considered to be one of the major, you know, philosopher of language of that time, 400 AD. So it is the same Bhartrihari who wrote Shatakas, yes? This is what we call Subhashitas, yes? Those proverbs, interesting statements. How do you call them otherwise? These aphorisms. Yeah? Developing the thought of Patanjali, Bhartrihari goes even farther and makes an overall survey of what single entity is and how it works on all levels of speech. For Bhartrihari, a sentence is a single, undivided speech unit and not a single word. A sentence, a text. It's what I was showing, nama and akhyata. If this nama and akhyata are not there, nama does not make sense. If sentence is not there, if secondary name is not used, there is no meaning. He goes even farther. This meaning is inherent in consciousness of man from his very birth, with which he later finds his partial correspondent in his language and reproduces it through articulation. And that is what...
Maybe the previous sentence would be also interesting. Did you speak the whole world as it is, as a meaning?
Yes. I skipped it, unfortunately. Oh, yeah, no, I didn't see it. You are right. The whole world as it is has a meaning which can be grasped only as indivisible unity. Now, it's on this that he builds his perception. Now, he says that every one of us, being part of this world, knows the world. And because we all know the world, we can communicate. Otherwise, we will never be able to communicate and learn foreign languages. How would we be able, if there is no common ground or common context, which we all know as such? Moreover, it's an interesting thing because when artificial intelligence was introduced, you remember, and they tried to explain to computer the meaning of the word, they couldn't do it. You know why? Because you start explaining one thing, computer asks you another thing. So if you say, what is the book is the thing with pages and words and sentences in it. Computer asks you, what is this thing? And what is pages? And what is words? And what is to read? And you say, to read is man is reading. Who is man? Man is, and more you explain, more you have to explain. So there is no way that you can stop your explanation because this explanation grows higher and higher, wider and wider, and the end you have everything. So there are modules already found how to stop these explanations and to cut the meanings into portions and make hierarchies of them, because otherwise you can't explain things. So it seems when we speak simple sentence, we imply all that knowledge in every word and sentence, how it relates to the whole totality. And if it is not relating to totality, it has no meaning. So where is meaning coming from? From the word? Or from the totality in which this world is introduced?
Can you give an example? For example, when I say, I am hungry, can you give an example of how this works then?
Well,
it's...
Yes, I am hungry. First of all, what is I? Everybody knows what is I. It's such a subjective state of being and consciousness, which implies so many relations with the whole world and yourself. So that one word is enough to really stop and not to be able to explain what is I. Can you explain objectively what I is? And what is am? To be? Can you explain to computer what is to be? And hungry? All the processes, what is hunger and what is food? And how it is and how, why it is so, it will ask you all the questions. So, in a way, when you say, I am hungry, you imply that we all know what it is. We know what is food, what is to eat, what is to be hungry, what is to grow, to die, to be born, and so on and so forth. All these contexts and meanings are there implied in this particular simple sentence which seem to be cut off. But it is not cut off in our linguistic space, in our semantic space. So for Bhartrihari, this is this Brahman, or that indivisible reality, the reality of the word, Akshara Brahman, that indivisible being from which we draw our meanings. So spota literally means sudden opening, disclosure. It is taking place in both, speaker and hearer, through the process of articulation in both. The sound of the speech, dvani, simply evokes the spota of the hearer as varna spota, pada spota, vakya spota, the phoneme, morpheme, articulation, cognition, the word articulation, cognition, and the text articulation, cognition, respectively. The differentiation between sound and articulation is one of the fundamental features of the theory of spota. Spota is not a sound we hear, but the sound we articulate. We are not hearing the sound. Now, when I speak to you, you are listening to my dhvani, but what you do, you notice the difference that I am not an English speaker. You notice that I have an accent. This accent comes from my Russian background. But you don't pay attention to it. You are paying attention to the re-articulating the meaning within your own linguistic space. You are articulating my articulations. You make it your own by re-articulating them. This is about the Sphota theory. So according to Bhartrihari, Sphota operates within universal sounds, whereas Dvani within a particular sound. Here every sentence is meaningful in this article. So you can see universal sounds, it's exactly what you are listening to. You are listening not to my particular articulation. You are listening to those articulated universal sounds which you can draw to yourself and make your own. Dvani as such, and that was the fun thing, I remember I already mentioned it before, when I tried to use computer for my improving my English articulation. You remember there were such programs, you record the word and it has to know it as you will read it and it will type for you. So I tried everything and it didn't work. The computer didn't recognize my English word articulation. It cannot hear, it's deaf, it listens to dhvani, it listens to this natural sound, it does not listen to the articulation, inarticulation, which we all listen to. That's why we can recognize all different dialects, we can recognize all different speakers from different countries with very bad English. We can make out what they say, because we are not listening to their sounds. We are hearing their articulation of universal sounds and we are re-articulating the meaning. So, the opposition between Sphota and Dvani is also presented as the opposition of class to individual. You can think in those philosophical terms. In modern terms, Sphota can be understood as having constant distinctive phonetic features, whereas Dvani is of a phonic nature, as a sound, as such, and nothing else. Sphota is that which is to be manifested, Vyangya, and Dvani is manifesting, Vyanjaka. Sphota is not uttered, but it is perceived by the hearer. It's beautiful. It's really, one can think about this all the time. To make the distinction clearer, Bhartrihari introduces two types of dvani, prakrita dvani, natural sound, and vikrita dvani, uttered or distorted sound, where Sphota is revealed through the former only. The secondary vikrita sounds are only to indicate the primary ones, and thus to kindle up this portal with which with the help of pratibha, a flash of insight, reveals the meaning of the text. And here, of course, pashyanti has to flash. If pashyanti is not flashing, then there is no meaning understood. And I'm happy that we did tantric research last time, because now we can refer to it and it will be easier for us to understand. So on semantic level, it was developed by later grammarians, Sphota makes the text correspond with the universal text totality, Shabda Brahman. And therefore the text can be easily understood as such. And once the inner perception, Pratibha, of the hearer flashes out, reflecting something from that totality, the Sphota, the revelation of the meaning of the text, takes place in his consciousness. So I stop here with Bhartrihari and I go to the general overview of all major theories of Sphota. Maybe it's already... What is the time?
5:05.
It took all my time today. Maybe we will leave it for the next time, because this I will not be able to do in 10 minutes. I need for this at least 40 minutes. To overview how Sphota works. And what is interesting, I will leave you with today, is that Varna Sphota, the Sphota of articulation of the sounds, what we hear, and what we were looking Kakha Gaghana into Sanskrit alphabet, these are not Prakrita Dvani, so to say. They are not Dvani at all. These are Sphota creations. These are universal sounds to which we refer in our Sphota articulation. We refer to them, recognize them. We see, we hear different sounds. Many people say yoga, yoga, yoga for yoga. And then you have to really, some German have different vowels, some French have different vowels. There is always this adjustment made to recognize that's Varna Sphota. What that Varna they want to articulate. Though naturally they do it differently. So what I want to say here is very interesting. When I will take a flute or a trumpet or piano and I will make you a sound. I don't have now, but it would be very fun to see if I take a flute and what would you hear? Is it some articulated sound? It's sound.
Oh, I heard before the instruments.
Yeah, but it is not this Sphota. Can you see? It's not Sphota. It's a sound, but it is not. If I make, you know, the closing trumpet, then you will hear, you will hear oo. Why? Because there are lips, double, so they're opening, closing, and it reminds us our own articulation. That's why we can say it's oo, or that is ah, or it's ah. Some kind of sound. We can imitate those sounds, but they are not Sphota. They are not mentally marked and articulated sounds.
But isn't there some emotion behind
it? Emotion, yes.
So emotion is not that. So.
Yes, we assign to it our articulation, and we make it human-like, and we bring our emotion into it, into particular context, but they are not Sphota. Sphota is this sound which is articulated by our apparatus, rearticulated, what we utter and not what we hear.
Some kind of example would be a bird song. A bird song would be an example of this, because suddenly hear it, the birds say, yes?
Yes. Now if you understand birds' language, that means you are able to penetrate into their articulation, into their Sphota. Now why we don't understand foreign languages? If I start speaking to you in Russian, you would not understand much. Why? Because you do not have the same articulation within, and there are meanings of the words and syntax which you do not follow. You do not follow the grammar, the words, everything, but mainly it is this articulatory device which we are not following. You know, it took me 6 months to be in Korea to start to distinguish words and phrases without knowing anything, just listening to the words, to the flow. I started to see the words, the ends of phrases. So I started to slowly articulate in my inner space their articulations. For both.
For what we hear.
For hear and speak, the same.
Not for the person speaking.
Yes, for hear also articulation.
Also, this is my mistake in understanding.
But it is so. You will see it. We had even jokes. In order to learn Georgian language, you first have to start speaking, you know, with Georgian accent in Russia. You start speaking in Georgian Russian, and then slowly you grow into that articulation. and then you will be able to do this. And it is very true, by the way. It is so true that it is fantastic. So you learn that accent of particular kind of people coming from that land, and through their accent you will understand how they, how their this spota works within their own mind.
Ah, that's funny. I know a man and he had not any education. He went to Spain. He did not understand a word, but he spoke Dutch with a Spanish accent. And he had communicated great with the people.
My sister, she, her husband is French, and she speaks English with such French accent. I always tell her, what is it with your English? Or English, some kind of... Because she lives with him. She hears that articulation. She has to communicate with him. And you know Jackie, who is very heavy French, he met once people here somewhere, and he spoke to them, explaining to them, and they said, please speak English. He said, it's English! This is exactly how it was really powerful French, and it was all English.
An hour and a half.
Everybody was
speaking French and English.
So the best way to learn French is to speak English with Satpram for a while, and then you will have access. So here we will stop, and next time we will start again with this general overview of all major theories of Spota, how this disclosure of meaning takes place through varna, through articulation of those sounds, through pada, through the word, through Vakya, through the text, and other theories which are very interesting to look into. Okay, so we will end with a minute of silence.
Is Spota learned?
Yes, it's acquired. Yes, by lifetime you acquire it. You speak that language, you articulate, and you learn.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah.